Well, if you think the governor vetoed the appropriation for the Renewable Energy Fund, not quite. He cut it in half. Still, that's $25 million. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The annual Business of Clean Energy Conference is coming up. Chris Rose, the Renewable Energy Project, Renewable Energy Alaska Project, is back. Our number statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Talk at APRN.org. Is there actual movement on renewable energy? That's the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Chris Rose, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve.
We have an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, and people certainly taking a more serious look at renewable energy. But up in Alaska, I think it was already on its way. It seems like what did it was the price tag. It's been about 3-4 years now. Alaskans on Talk of Alaska just can't talk enough about energy. So I'm glad to have you back.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. You know, energy is the lifeblood of any economy. And if you can't have affordable and predictably priced energy, it's really hard to attract investment. And I think what's going on in the Gulf is a demonstration that the easy energy, the stuff that came out of the ground quite easily and was relatively cheap, that the age of that easy energy is over, or at least ending. And what Michael Clare, who's a professor at Hampshire College, calls extreme energy is starting to come into play, which means that you've got to go further out, deeper, and try new technologies. And I think that all of those things are happening, and what we're trying to demonstrate at this conference coming up is that Alaska has a great opportunity to be part of this next industrial revolution on energy.
If nothing else, the Gulf of Mexico blowout is going to make it more expensive to
That's
be
right.
looking for oil.
That's right, and I think it might reflect the true cost.
Yeah.
Right now, the cost is being externalized onto those people who live in the Gulf and onto the ecosystem. If the cost of greater regulation had been passed on to BP and other oil companies, then maybe they could pass it back on to the consumer. I think consumers would pay that ultimately, but then we'd be paying more of a true cost for that product.
Business of Clean Energy. This is an annual thing now.
Yeah, this is our second year. We had a sold-out crowd last year. We had people from all over the country come and explain what folks in other states have been doing to both do energy efficiency and develop renewable energy. And it was such a success, we decided to continue it through and have an annual event. We had a really great, I'd say, legislative session this year in terms of the strides forward that the legislature made on energy and energy policy. And we're hoping that a lot of the conversation that's been taking place over the last year will continue at the conference.
And so you have, well, let's see, let's just run down through. The ones I see is the Green Building Council, greenbiz.com, Jack A. Bear is going to be back, and Geothermal Guy.
Yeah, we've got a person who's the president of the International Geothermal Association from Reykjavik, Iceland. And what he's going to talk about is how they have used what they call their stranded renewable energy resources, the resources that are far away from their population centers, to attract industry. Because we've got the same thing here. We've got tremendous wind, geothermal, and even ocean energy resources in places like the Aleutian Islands. But there's relatively few people living out there to attract an investment to exploit that energy resource. But if you were to decide to bring the industry to that energy, or you were going to decide to figure out a way to make that energy transportable, like, for instance, making ammonia fuel and then moving that around in a tanker, then you might have a business opportunity out there that we're overlooking right now.
One thing that I didn't really know until the last couple of years is how power intensive it is to concentrate ores. The pebble mine, they say, would require, whether it happens or not, we'll see. But if it were to be built, that mine would require an enormous source of power, which is, of course, located nowhere near there. Think about putting power lines all down that valley there to get to Lake Iliamna, all the way from Cook Inlet. That's one possibility that's being talked about. You have a similar problem, and a little bit more imminent, probably, at Donlin Creek, where they're really just ready to mine, but they got to have the power. Mm-hmm. Where do you get power out there in the YK Delta?
Well, these are big questions.
Yeah, they're huge questions, and there's not good answers.
Especially when we're looking at a relative shortage of available predictably priced power for our citizens. Right now, we're really dependent on natural gas-fired electricity, for instance, in Cook Inlet, in the rail belt. About 90% of Chugach's power, for instance, comes from natural gas. And yet, we know we are looking at a relative shortage of at least cheap natural gas. And we have really old natural gas generators over across the inlet at Beluga that are burning that natural gas relatively inefficiently. That's why Chugach and MLMP are building the new gas plants here in town. So we have to, I think, really decide that we're going to look at the solutions for Alaska's citizens first, especially if we're going to be winding up spending any state money to subsidize the cost of new energy projects.
Hmm. Well, you said you had a good legislative session, but of course, having said that, we then had a bunch of vetoes. We've got a governor that's running for re-election and definitely wanted to come across as a fiscal conservative. And so what he tended to do was take a lot of projects that are going to take a number of years and say, we're not going to do all this at once. And so he would take the budget of, you know, often cut things in half. Mm-hmm. And he did that with the Renewable Energy Fund. Now, really, that would not pay off right away, right? I mean, $50 million, what's wrong with cutting that down to $25 million?
Well, there's a lot of people who are disappointed with that. The legislature appropriated $50 million this year for the Renewable Energy Fund. The Alaska Energy Authority had actually identified over $60 million with the good projects, but they only recommended $50 million to the legislature. The legislature appropriated that money, and then the governor cut that in half. What it in effect does is it really hurts 46 different projects, and about 22 of those were reconnaissance and feasibility projects, which didn't need a lot of money, but they needed some upfront money to even see whether there was a resource in the vicinity of that community.
Okay, so these are projects that already got vetted through.
All those projects have been vetted. The process works such that the Energy Authority looks at all these applications and then gives a list to the legislature. And this year, like I said, they had over $60 million worth of projects. They only submitted a list of 50, and they had a bright line at 25. And so basically, all of the projects that got hurt by the veto were the ones after the $25 million. And again, there's 46 projects.
And what that does is it holds up the planning and feasibility process.
Of those projects, and then it holds up the design and construction of others. The other thing to note is that of those $25 million in projects that got vetoed, they would have leveraged over $50 million of federal and private money. So it wasn't like the state money was going to pay for the entire cost of those projects. Oh. And now some of those projects are in real danger of losing their federal funding, because if they don't have it this year, that may go somewhere else, or the private investors, which is the same thing. So from our perspective, it was short-sighted because those projects are necessary, especially since another bill that was passed this year is an energy policy that sets a goal for the state of getting 50% of its electricity from renewables by 2025. We need to get these projects in the pipeline moving in order to do that.
So you have a deadline, and then you put everything off for a year, or half of them off for a year. I get it. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. It's a local call at Anchorage at 550-8422, and the email is talk@APRN.org. And once again, we're talking renewable energy for Alaska with Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. He's been with us before, and it's his job to be a little bit forward-looking on some of these projects, but also to be the midwife of actually trying to get them actually happening. So how close are we to, let's say, tidal energy?
Well, funny you should ask, because one of the tidal projects that would have been demonstrated was one of the projects that got hurt by this veto. And in fact, over $4.5 million of private money is at stake in that project. That would have been a project by Ocean Renewable Power Company out here in Cook Inlet. Cook Inlet is recognized really from folks around the world as one of the best places to demonstrate tidal energy. And with 90% of the country's tidal energy potential here in Alaska, we really should be the leaders. In fact, we'll have one of the leaders in the tidal energy business in the entire United States coming to our conference here next week. And to talk about just what we have here, I think a lot of people in Alaska don't even realize the opportunity that we have here with tidal and also wave energy.
Yeah,
but it's all in demonstration phases.
Yeah, I went to, I don't know if you'll have the presentation, but it's a really interesting presentation. The Knick Arm turbine design process has been, it was really interesting to watch how the engineers actually get down to the business of, okay, now we got to have fish passage. We don't want to bother the belugas. we need something that is actually going to be stable through these. It's quite the process.
Yeah, I think the big issue with tidal energy is not that we haven't figured out a way to generate electricity from the tides. It's we haven't developed really robust equipment that we know will last in the water for a long time without a lot of maintenance.
A lot of abrasion, I guess.
With
all this.
Yeah, it's a really harsh environment, especially up here. So it's really designing a very robust system that will work without a lot of O&M. And then, as you say, making sure that it's not going to impact the marine environment. And the other thing that is often overlooked is making sure that the regulators follow along so that by the time the equipment is ready, the regulations are in place too. We don't have another wait just to make sure that it's regulated property. So Sean O'Neill, who's the president of the Ocean Renewable Energy Coalition in the Washington, D.C. area, which is actually the trade association for the United States' wave and tidal power, will be speaking at the conference next week.
Well, what is the administration's posture going to be with regards to your conference? I mean, is this an embarrassment? I mean, because probably the administration is going to come in for a little criticism here. I can't imagine, for instance, Mira Kohler not getting up and slamming him a bit.
Well, I think that the criticism on the veto, if that's what you're talking about, is starting to mount. Gene Theriault, who is the in-state senior policy advisor for the governor, is going to be making welcoming remarks. He'll be there on Thursday. And, you know, I think it's
That'll be fun to watch.
It's a tough situation for him to come into, I think, because there are going to be a lot of people who are saying, I don't know, what the heck? You know, the legislature approved this money. This impacts communities all across the state. And as I said, it would have leveraged a lot of federal and private money.
Yeah. So we'll just have to, it just makes it more interesting from a political point of view. Meanwhile, you have people that are rolling up their sleeves and trying to figure out whether it makes a difference for their bottom line. So what do you have? Do you have a trade show?
We do have essentially a trade show. We have an exhibit hall. There'll be over 30 different companies and organizations exhibiting outside of the conference area on the third floor at the Denina Center. And that part is free and open to the public. So even if you don't want to pay to get into the listen to the speakers, you can come over to the third floor of the Denina Center for both Thursday and Friday of next week, the 17th and 18th, and you can just mill around and see the companies that are exhibiting what they're doing and talk to the organizations that are involved with renewable energy and energy efficiency. And that's the other thing to remember. This conference is really split into 2 days. The first day is about efficiency. The second day is about renewables. And those two together are really what we're calling clean energy.
Efficiency. That's
right.
Interesting. You know, it's fairly self-evident that we have a lot of waste. So you would think that this would be one of our big potential savings.
Oh, it's huge.
But things aren't designed real efficiently. And it takes time and research and development to get to better design.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there. In fact, the way that we're structuring that first day is, well, first we'll talk about retrofitting, which is dealing with a bad design and making it better and more efficient. But the middle panel of that day, we'll be talking about efficient design from the start. And we'll have architects coming in and talking about how you can design from scratch houses that actually produce more energy than they use. We'll have one architect from Stuttgart, Germany, who's designing net zero energy plus houses, meaning that he's actually designing homes that are generating more power than they're using and sending it to their neighbors.
Net zero energy plus.
That's right. And then Jack Abair, as you mentioned, from the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, will also speak on that panel. And he'll talk about designing homes and buildings for the bush using more local materials and traditional knowledge, but 21st century technology. And so he's already been working on prototype projects in Aktivik Pass, in places like Newtok. And of course, if we're going to be having to move any of these villages because of climate change and sea level rise, it makes sense to design the new village to be as efficient and modern as possible.
Yeah, it's been pointed out to me that in many cases with people that are semi-nomadic, the concept of the village was essentially set up by the missionaries.
Right.
And because the missionaries are mostly here in the summertime, they put them right next to the river where they could get to by a boat.
Right. And they could have moved a lot easier without the airport and the school and everything. But now we've made those investments.
Right.
And that's another reason that energy is so important. The state has sunk literally billions of dollars into these villages.
Yes.
Okay. And none of this is going to work unless the energy is affordable. And so that's why energy is such a important and primary issue here. If we cannot run these sewer systems and these schools and everything that we build, people will leave, and then that investment will just be sunk out there.
Well, I think a lot of people want to see the tangible examples, and I think they're beginning to come down the pipeline. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to have you here, because you know more about it than me. But I know, for instance, a lot of people got excited about that house up in Aktivik Pass, mm-hmm. essentially using the traditional sod house technology, but as you say, with modern materials.
Right, and a little bit of modern know-how. And those the house that Jack has designed in Aktivik is just an amazing house, both for the energy efficiency portion of it, but also just the functionality of it for the people who live there. We'll also have a panel that day on the efficiency day talking about efficiency in generation and transmission, because oftentimes we're just thinking about the building. What we're also going to talk about is more efficient generators, less line loss, putting your generators closer to where you're actually using the power, which is what's called distributed generation. And we'll have experts from around the country on that issue talking about what we could be doing to make that part of our forte up here, because we already have all these very isolated villages. And in fact, we could be leaders in this kind of technology.
I don't want to put you on the spot because I know you're there for renewable energy. However, the Susitna Dam is back.
Mm-hmm.
This is a proposal essentially to locate a generation center someplace where there's really no demand.
Well,
and then transmit the power from there. Now, when you think about it, if you look at it, you know, take a big map and put it on there, you can say, well, actually, the population isn't that far from.
Right.
Yeah.
The population isn't that far. I think the issue, there's lots of issues with these hydro dams and hydro projects that people are talking about and concerned about. The state is now in the process of, they just got $10 million appropriated by this legislative session to essentially start doing fatal flaw analysis on a few of these hydro projects to narrow down the field and see what is the best possible deal for the rail belt. Susitna is one of them. Lake Chacachamna, which is a lake tap, is another. There are potential environmental issues. The biggest issues, though, are really cost and who's going to pay for it. And it gets back to this issue that I discussed before about if the state is going to pay for it, are the people of the state going to get the benefit from it? Or is it going to be a situation where, you know, 25 years ago they were saying, we'll build this and then they will come, meaning industry will come and then industry will get that subsidized power. And I think that people are concerned that if the state's going to be spending our limited resources on, let's say, paying down half the cost of Susitna or paying down half the cost of Chacachamna, that power goes right back into the rail belt and benefits the people.
I'm sure we'll come back to that Chacachamna, but for now, let's start with the calls. You ready, Chris?
Sure.
It's Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. The Business of Clean Energy Conference is coming up later part of next week. And the telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and email is talk at aprn.org. We got open lines right now, and we have Andy on the air from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Chris Rose, Andy.
Hey, it's nice to be on. Actually, Chris and I know each other. I own a company called Your Clean Energy, which I started in 2005, and we do energy audits. We do financial evaluation of renewable systems and design. And my question for Chris, and just kind of a comment, is that we've noticed about 40 to 50% of our income for consulting is coming from private investors. In other words, people putting up the money directly themselves, a company or individuals, and then the other half is coming from grant funds that organizations have applied for from the state or from the Denali Commission. And I wondered if Chris could comment generally in Alaska. You know, we're seeing this big increase in funds from the state. But what is the balance between those funds and private investment? And that's, I think it's an important question, because as we get more private investment, then we have an economy that's is sustainable beyond the allocations from the state government. In other words, economy is going and people keep investing. Businesses are growing without the grant funds, and I wonder if he could comment on that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a business question.
Well, it really depends a lot on the project you're talking about. With energy efficiency, for instance, there's a thing called performance contracting, where you can actually have a company come in and do the work for you and finance it for you, and you pay back that company for the services they provided and the improvements they've made to your building through the energy savings. So that's a nice finance model. There's a million finance models out there with a combination of federal money, state money, private money, and I do think that it is important to strike the right balance, and I think that's what policy is about, is trying to figure out how you do that. A lot of states actually collect money from the ratepayers themselves through things called system benefit charges, which are little surcharges on your bill, and a lot of states finance their energy efficiency and renewable energy projects that way. The state of Alaska has so few people that we felt that it would make a lot more sense for us to use general fund appropriations to do grants, because we have a lot of oil revenues that are coming in, and we would be able to generate more money up front. And the other thing about renewable energy, if you're doing projects, is if you're talking about a public project that serves a public utility in a large area, the long-termness of that project really, is a big part of the financing, and how long is that project going to last? With large hydro, it might last for 100 years, and so maybe the policy call is to support that through public dollars, because it's going to be such a long public benefit. If it's a smaller project that might only benefit a private entity, of course, then that entity probably should get some private financing. There's limited dollars for sure, and I think that Andy's right that those dollars, the state and federal dollars, are not going to be there forever.
Andy, wouldn't you say that it must have a lot to do with the cost of fuel? I mean, people look at efficiency when their fuel what they pay for fuel goes up, right?
Yeah, that's a big driver. We saw, for example, when the natural gas and heating oil took a spike a couple years ago, our phones started ringing because the payback on the alternative energy or renewable energy systems, suddenly dropped. In some cases down as low as 5 years. And that's what we see in business. A business wants to get their money back in 3 to 5 years or less, and there's always a gap. And if Chris is correct, if we have this balance where there's some incentive coming in, but also private investment, people won't take something more seriously than when they have their own money in the game. If it's a private system. And if it's a public system, then if it's their state dollars, they want to see a return on it. So, yeah, as these fossil fuel prices go up, investment increases. And one thing we've tried to do to help people understand that is that you have to look at the long-term trend of escalation. That's what's going to drive the payback. In other words, it may not pay back against today's energy prices, but we know that, gas and oil is going to be moving at a certain escalation rate that we can predict with some accuracy, and that's going to drive the payback down. And so part of this whole thing is getting people to think long term, and then the investment is easier for them to make.
Yeah. Andy, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, it is a little, gets a little clumsy here when there's a big blowout in the Gulf of Mexico and the price of crude oil goes down. And it's been happening for the last month, you know. It's going down from, what, the upper 80s down to around 70.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And yet the spare capacity on the planet right now is still relatively small, you know, around a million barrels a day. So, you know, a small fluctuation in supply and demand can really throw things out of whack. And there's a lot of people who believe that demand is growing so quickly that it's going to be really, really hard for supply to keep up. And right now we're in a, you know, we're in a recession still relatively, and that's one of the reasons that demand's down.
Right. And, you know, also I think people are nervous because of what's going on in Europe. Mm-hmm. Then we see investment going down there, demand going down there, mm-hmm. and they see the inventories being pretty good. Mm-hmm. They see no reason why the price would go up.
Ironically, it's a good time to put in renewable energy projects because there's no fuel cost of renewable energy. It's just cost of capital. And so the cost of capital is down in a recession. Cost of raw materials is down. It's the time to buy the concrete and the steel and get the project in the ground.
Aha! Uh-huh. All right. Okay, let's go to Harry in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Harry.
Hello. You're singing my tune.
It's Harry Crawford.
Time to buy the concrete and the steel. Absolutely.
Hey, Harry, I guess we should, in the interest of disclosure, say that you're running for the U.S. House this year.
I am. Yeah. But, you know, what I've been doing for the last 10 years is trying to have a brighter future for Alaska, which is renewable energy. There's freedom in renewable energy. And, you know, you're held prisoner to the price, the worldwide price of fossil fuels, as long as we're stuck on gas and oil and coal. Don't let me forget coal. I just wanted to call in and say, you know, that Chris Rose is the best spokesman for renewable energy that we see in Juneau every year, and there's nobody better or more knowledgeable about bringing that forward.
Thanks, Harry.
So Harry, what you're seeing is basically what Chris was talking about, that it's just the veto of half of the money going into the renewable energy fund. There were already projects for all that money, so this essentially just puts off projects or alternatively, feasibility examinations of whether or not projects are go or no go.
Of all the vetoes that the governor could have made, this is the most short-sighted. It's the one that makes the least sense in the long run. You know, the Renewable Energy Fund is one of the things that I'm most proud of that I had a hand in. You know that I was part of the legislature that put the Renewable Energy Fund together. There were a lot of people that had a lot to do with it, and certainly not the least of which was Chris Rose. I mean, he worked day and night to get the Renewable Energy Fund in place, and then to veto half of it, it is just, I mean, I can't come up with a better word than short-sighted. We're robbing our future.
Harry, did you have any clue as you were laboring away on this in the House? Did you have any clue from the third floor that this might happen?
No.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
No, none of us did. None of us did, and we've been asking repeatedly since the legislative session ended, and we haven't gotten any indication. And so there's a lot of shocked and dismayed people. There are still people out there who are literally in shock because they were moving ahead on the project. They were about to ink contracts. You know, they thought this was a done deal, and now they're totally, you know, back on their heels.
Oops, the deal's off. Harry, thanks for your call.
Oh, you bet.
All right.
Love to call in. I love your show, and this is the topic that supersedes all the others with me.
Yeah, well, and for a lot of other Alaskans as well. Thanks so much, Harry Crawford. It's Talk of Alaska. The subject is renewable energy. Chris Rose of Renewable Energy Alaska Project is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Well, one of the great pleasures of doing this program is that it's broadcast all over Alaska and all over the incredible and forceful geography of the state of Alaska and all its true magnificence and diversity and sometimes almost indifference to the scale of humanity. And we get comments like this from Carl Schleich in Wasilla, who says, "Dear Talk of Alaska, I just flew over Lake Chokochami yesterday. What an amazing place. It seems like such a no-brainer to drill a hole and put in a power plant to plug into the grid. The numbers I've heard seem to make it a very feasible project. Clean, environmentally friendly. You shut it off July, August when the fish are running, and our power demands are lower, and free energy for 100 years out. What are the numbers, and what is the best thinking to financing and getting Chokochami going?" I guess you got to start with the geography here. And also, there is a fish run.
Yeah, the geography is that if people can see Mount Spur from Anchorage on a clear day, Chokochami is essentially right there at the foot of Mount Spur. So it's about 80 miles west of Anchorage across Cook Inlet. It's nearby the Beluga power plant now, where the Beluga's gas field is. And so that's important because the transmission system that serves the rail belt in Anchorage starts over there. So it's only about 40 miles from transmission. So you've got potential geothermal project at Mount Spur. You've got this potential hydro project at Chokochami. You've got potential wind over there at the Western Forelands, as well as tidal energy in the western part of Cook Inlet that could all tie into this one single grid. Chokochami is what we call a lake tap project, similar to what we've got down at Briley Lake, at Aklutna Lake, Cooper Lake, where you don't have a dam, you drill a tunnel underneath the lake, and then you let the gravity flow come down to a powerhouse and you create power. This would be roughly a 330 megawatt project, and the latest estimate is $1.7 billion. With a B. 330 megawatts. All these hydro projects have what's called a capacity factor, meaning that you can only generate that amount of power about half of the year on these. So, you know, if you were to average it out, it'd be like 170 megawatts or so of power, 165 megawatts of power during the course of the year. That's still a lot. The peak load of the whole rail belt on the darkest, coldest winter day is about 850 megawatts. And so if you plug in 170 megawatts into the grid, that is a big deal. Plus, it's going to have a predictable price the entire life of the project. And that's why renewable energy is so important. You're going to attract investment if people who want to come here and do business know what the cost of doing business is going to be. And energy is a big cost. The Briley Lake model, as they are calling it, is what has been talked about for these hydro projects, meaning that the state would likely pay down half of the cost so that they could get into the bond market for the other half, and then revenue bonds that would be paid for by the ratepayers over the course of the years would pay the other half down. And so we're essentially looking at a half subsidy by the state to do something like that. Chokochami, like I said, $1.7 billion. The Susitna project that they were looking at is a $5 billion model of that, or $5 billion scenario. So that'd be $2.5 billion that the state would have to come up with. And you know, like I said, the state right now is spending $10 million to continue with some of the studies they've already begun to see whether or not one or both of these projects make sense. There's also a project, I believe they're calling it Glacier Fork. It's just an idea right now up in the Kinnick River Valley that might be a pretty significant hydro project for the rail belt.
Really?
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And I think one of the big issues with Chacachanda right now is we just don't know enough about the impacts on the salmon. There are five species of salmon that go up there. But again, this is not a dam. So we have to figure out how the taking the water out of the bottom of the lake and moving it down to another drainage would impact the fish. So far, there's no indications it's going to be a deal breaker, but we just don't know. We haven't done enough research.
Well, of course, there is a volcano there.
Well, the volcano's there, but, you know, Ormat, which is the biggest geothermal developer in the country, has bought the lease to explore for geothermal there at Mount Spur, and they're very experienced, and they clearly are not concerned about the volcano being right there. Yeah. And the geothermal project would be very, very close to the Lake Tap project if they both went.
Well, we got a stack of calls here. Let's do the Barrow one next. Louisa joins the program from Barrow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Chris Rose, Louisa.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Yeah. We're talking about reusable energy.
Renewable.
Yeah. There's sun during the summer, and then we have the wind, which is always up here,
mm-hmm.
and the water. So what's anybody doing about that?
Well, there's a lot going on, Louisa. As you know, the wind blows in a lot of places. There's probably 100 villages in the state that have developable wind. And in just over the last 10 years or so, 22 of those villages have put in some form of wind power to accompany the diesel that they've got. And they're calling them wind diesel hybrid systems. And you probably have that opportunity in Barrow. I don't know if anybody has put up an anemometer there. That's what you have to do first, is put up a wind measuring device to figure out exactly what your resource is. But clearly people are moving ahead, and that's what this Renewable Energy Grant Fund is all about, is providing some seed money to get these projects in the ground. But you know, like I said, 22 out of the 100 villages that probably have good wind have already gone there.
And but there is some natural gas there, right? Don't they burn some gas in a power plant? Did I hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that's it's pretty, when it's right there and it's a fairly small community, that's pretty good fuel.
But still, there's the wind, the sun, and the water.
Yeah.
And we have plenty of that.
We sure
but
do.
What is anybody doing about that?
Well, there's a lot of people doing a lot of things. I just don't know who's doing what there in Barrow, Louisa, and I think that's something to bring up to your local city council and your state legislator and the other people who are interested, your utility, and the people who are making the power.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, Barrow has to take some leadership there in the utility. Louisa, thanks for your call from Barrow.
Okay.
It's great to hear from you. All the way up there. Let's go to Martha, joins the program from Anchorage. Martha, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
Hi.
Louisa, I think there may be a tendency to oversimplify the simple things that she says, but there are a handful of villages on the North Slope, and only a couple of them have access to cheap natural gas, and only one village, Nootsik, is tapping into the oil field, and that's only been recently, and they've watched the gas flare for over 20, going on 30 years, I believe, before they even got anything in their neighborhood. But I really, really appreciate the show, and if you could step back a bit, Chris, and educate people like Louisa and others in the village who know that they can, that they have a resource, but they don't know how to tap into it. Even your aside about the wind anemometer, how do you say that? Anemometer. Even conversation about that, that's the first step. You're looking at people desperate to reduce costs in the villages. I've talked with a village board, corporation board, up on the North Slope about the wind power that's available. Could you speak in the big picture? What are the steps involved? Like 1, 2, 3, 4, or what do villages do? What do citizens do?
I think that's a really, really good question.
Okay, and then as far as the legislature, I find it really offensive, having been raised in urban Alaska, but having ties to rural Alaska, that this state legislature is more than happy to serve the rail belt with permanent projects, and it has for years subsidized the Anchorage rail belt all the way to Fairbanks, but cannot find without great effort and a lot of headaches causing to come up with reliable money for rural Alaska, where we get our wealth from. So I have that as a concern as far as going to the legislature. For what? More inequality?
Well, maybe I could address that first. When the Renewable Energy Grant Fund was passed in 2008, one of the statutory criteria was that the money goes to the places with the highest cost of energy. And so that was a very clear signal that most of this money was going to be going to the rural areas. And in fact, most of the money that's been appropriated so far, $150 million over the last 3 years, is going to projects in the rural areas, because I think everybody recognized that the highest cost places need the help first. Very little of that $150 million has gone to the rail belt. I think you're right that the rail belt has gotten a lot of benefits from other projects, and those have been separate appropriations. But the Renewable Energy Grant Fund in and of itself still has that statutory criteria that gives a leg up to projects and places where the costs are really high. So there has been $150 million. That's why the veto is concerning. Of those 46 projects that are hurt by the veto of the $25 million this year, most of them are in rural areas. I do think that the whole education of what we can do is super important. And as an education and advocacy group, that's what REAP really strives to do. We have had trainings in places like Dillingham and Bethel, and we're having one in Nome this fall. We are a small staff. We can't get around all everywhere, but we do partner with folks like the National Renewable Energy Lab, Alaska Energy Authority, the Denali Commission, to get out there and talk to people about what their options are. And we're actually working on a guide that would kind of answer some of the questions in the order that you asked them, which is, what do you do first? With wind, really, the first step is to ask the Alaska Energy Authority for an anemometer on loan. They have an anemometer loan program, and I don't know if enough people know about it, but that's how you start. You have to measure your resource, and for about a year. And, you know, Louisa also mentioned the sun, and a lot of people have overlooked solar power because we don't use a lot of energy in the summer when the sun's shining. You know, we don't need a lot of lights. We don't need air conditioning. But in fact, the technology is coming along where we might be able to start using solar power to drive our vehicles with electric vehicles. And in fact, out in St. Paul Island, TDX Corporation has already been testing an electric-powered four-wheeler that they are charging with wind power. And so that's something that many of these villages could be looking at is also not just getting off the diesel-powered electricity, but getting off gasoline-powered transportation, because that costs people money too.
And this is not all that far away. I mean, actually, I guess some communities are already doing this, aren't they, in Europe?
Well, yeah. I mean, electric vehicles are here.
The idea that instead of gas stations, you basically have charge stations.
Right.
And all the vehicles are power vehicles.
Well, there are a few places. I think Zermatt, Switzerland is one of them. Yeah. There are more and more of them. And that's kind of the whole idea of this conference, is that we want to bring the last frontier to the cutting edge. I mean, we're the last frontier, but the cutting edge is out there. And with the internet and with all our ability to know what's going on, there's no excuse for us not to take the best ideas from other places and say, hey, we can do it here because we've got some of the highest prices in the world. We have a great incentive to be trying to lower those prices through new technologies.
It's really exciting.
It is.
This note from Tom in Fairbanks is, hey, how about a power line from Prudhoe to Fairbanks? Fairbanks is already getting power from all the way down to Bradley Lake. If you do the numbers on the miles, it's the same distance. He says Healy Power could go south if Fairbanks didn't need it. Golden Valley found it economical to install a second 100-mile transmission line from Healy to Fairbanks across Tanana Flats. Building along the pipeline corridor would seem easier because of the road.
That's a very interesting idea, and I've heard that the administration has actually been looking into that a little bit. Of course, that would continue your reliance on natural gas, which in the short term might not be a bad thing. But essentially what that person is saying is, you know, have a natural gas-fired electricity plant up at Prudhoe Bay and then build a power line. And they would use a high-voltage DC power line, HVDC, which has a lot less line loss and works over those long distances, like 400 miles. So we don't know what the economics are. The ringer in that is you don't know what the cost of the gas is going to be. Okay, so if you could get a 20-year contract price on gas, then you would be able to estimate the economics of that project. Without that, though, anytime you build a gas plant, or for that matter, a coal plant, or anything that relies on fossil fuels, it's a wild card what your fuel is going to cost even a year down the road, let alone 20 or 25 years down the road when you still are paying off that project.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and then you think, well, if the gas line did actually happen, right now they haven't found enough gas to fill up the gas line. So all the whole supply and demand thing could be radically different.
Yeah, I mean,
20 years down the line, radically different.
I think, and I've talked to a lot of people who agree with this, I think part of our problem in Alaska is we almost have too many choices.
Yeah.
We're standing at the buffet and we're just staring at all the food. We can't decide what to do. And we really start, we need to start pulling the trigger on some of these decisions because energy keeps going up. The price of a lot of these materials is down now, and we need to decide.
Chris Rose is our guest, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. We're talking about the business of clean energy as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
And our next call is from Glacier Bay, where Michelle joins the program. Michelle, are you really in Glacier Bay?
I'm really in Glacier Bay. I'm actually in Gustavus, at the edge of the bay.
All right.
As close as cell phone coverage allows to being in the inner bay.
All right. Well, so you're listening to the show.
Yes, we've been listening to the show with great interest and really thrilled that you have Mr. Rose online, and the conversations have been great. As I've listened to this, I've also been recalling recent conversations that have been going on at the federal level with renewable energy, which is, of course, been viewed very favorably, it appears, by the Obama administration. And because of that, there's been a tremendous amount of focus on marine and coastal planning. And I guess I was curious whether Mr. Rose felt that with the enthusiasm expressed for renewable energy by the legislature in their voting to fund some projects, do you feel that there was also some recognition that by not engaging in some of these conversations about coastal and marine spatial planning, we might actually not be able to realize or pull the trigger on some of these projects because we don't have the policies and regulations in place to embrace the projects and ensure compatible uses of our coastal zones as well as environmental protection?
Oh, wow.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And of course, you know, past 3 miles off the shore, we're getting into federal waters that have federal jurisdiction. And we actually, REAP has actually been involved a little bit in some of the discussions with federal agencies on how they're going to start looking at leasing in federal waters for renewable energy, whether it be offshore wind or whether it be tidal and wave power. Wave power probably not going to happen that far out, neither is tidal, but it could be offshore wind. And maybe some other resources down the line. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, we have to be able to make sure that the regulators keep pace with the technology, because if we get this technology to a place where it's going to work, we don't want to have another long wait to figure out, well, how the heck are we going to, you know, lease this land or lease this water, or how are we going to make sure that our compatible uses? I think that there's some studies going on right now in, or there's being some studies proposed at least for Alaska Waters to start looking at a lot of those questions that the caller's asking.
Michelle, I take it you think the administration and some in the legislature might be putting their heads in the sands by thinking that we're not going to have marine spatial planning, that if they just don't look at it, it won't happen up here?
Well, I guess that's I pose that as somewhat of a question because I wasn't in the legislative hearings regarding renewable energy, but from what I hear in the media with regard to the administration's position with regard to coastal marine spatial planning.
They're saying it's zoning the oceans, and we don't want any part of it. We'd like to oppose it. I think that's their position.
Oppose it, and therefore my concern is we're out of the conversation. And I guess I wanted to find out whether Mr. Rose felt that the legislature recognizes this, and whether there's, in addition to funding and support for renewable energy, do we have funding going to fish and game and DNR and communities to look at our coastal zone management plans and maybe have some new staffing, an ocean policy advisor to interface at that state federal level, perhaps to be in the discussion. I mean, there's been massive investments on the East Coast that have been delayed tremendously due to lack of planning. The wind farms off Martha's Vineyard,
right,
and there's,
yeah,
wind farms and tidal generators proposed in areas where sport fishing felt they were going to be affected. And so some of these projects aren't going forward because of standstills, and those cost jobs and investments.
Yeah.
It'd be a tremendous loss for us, I think, if we didn't have the ability to move forward with some of the projects.
I think we're in the very, very early baby stages of that. I know, for instance, DNR has started to see a lot more demand on their staff time to just deal with the permitting issues associated with projects that are getting funded by the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. And so I think the state administration does have to realize that they have to staff up to make sure that these projects and these programs work effectively and that we get the money out the door. In terms of, though, federal waters offshore more than 3 miles, I don't see a lot of potential projects that are being discussed right now. And so I do think that's kind of back burner relative to some of these projects that are either on land or within state waters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear there's some discussions at DNR and that the legislature realizes just funding a project, buying steel, or getting investments means we need to have more support for the research and the community involvement in shaping the project. So it sounds like there's some things starting, which is great.
Right. And of course, Michelle, you probably know as well as I do, and probably Chris knows, that the CZM deal just fell apart at the last minute, but it's pretty much of a promise it's going to happen at the next legislative session.
Yeah, okay, I think this is a big issue, though. In fact, a couple of our speakers, actually more than a couple at the conference next week, are going to be talking about policy and structure. We'll have Roya Stanley, who's the head of the Office of Energy Independence in Iowa. Iowa now gets 19% of all their electricity from wind. So she's going to talk about how Iowa's state policy works. Same with the Oregon Energy Trust of Oregon. We'll have Peter West, who's the director of all their energy programs, talking about the structure that that the legislature's put in place in Oregon to make this work. And then finally, we'll have Liz Wooters, who's the director of the Clean Energy Fund for Emerging Technologies in British Columbia. We just got an Emerging Energy Technology Fund established through this legislative session. So she'll be talking to us about, well, how do you do that? If you're going to have a fund like that, what's the best policy? What's the best structure? Because we have to learn from that, too. It's policy, it's financing, and it's technology. It's all three of those things have to work together.
Well, you know as well as I do, when you actually often take a wonky point of view of state government, you go look at, well, what does Alaska have that's parallel to what they have over in Massachusetts? And you find, we have half of a position, if that. It often seems to be that way, Michelle, don't you think?
Seems to be. Well, thanks so much, and appreciate the work you're doing.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much for your call from Glacier Bay. See, there's that geography again. Let's go to Bruce, joins the program from Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bruce. Bruce, are you there? Oh, looks like we lost Bruce. He wanted to talk about geothermal energy. Let's go into that. The low-temp geothermal. Is this really happening? I mean, we know it's happening up in Chena Hot Springs. And it looks like Bernie Carl's doing everything he can to make this a commercial thing.
Yeah, it's called Organic Rankine Cycle. It's basically using low temperature water up there, 165 degree water, to make steam out of a refrigerant that boils at a lower temperature, and then that drive the turbine with that steam. And it's a closed loop system. And I think Bernie's done a tremendous amount to not only show Alaskans but people around the country that this is a possibility, because there's a lot of, for instance, warm liquids, hot liquids coming out of the ground at oil wells all around the country. They're pumping up hot water when they're also pumping up oil. And if it's 165 degrees or better, like what Bernie's got up at Chena, then there's a potential for making electricity. Same idea with perhaps burning biomass even to make hot water. So there's a possibility. Bernie's blessed with a very strong resource up there, a lot of water coming out of the ground. And so he's kind of a special case. But he has shown that this technology is adaptable to other places. And I think that, again, that's something that we want to focus on more with this emerging technology fund that just got passed by the legislature, so we can do a little bit more research and development on things that aren't commercial today but clearly could be commercialized within the next 3 to 5 years.
I've heard about using remote sensing just to find warmer spots of the crust of the earth as a geothermal resource.
Well, they geologists certainly know a lot more about this than we do, but there are a lot of techniques to find where you start to look. But really, when it boils down to it, you got to drill holes. And you got to find out what the temperature differences are and what the temperature of your water is, what the quantity of the water is. At Mount Spur, we're looking at a high temperature system where you would actually maybe be looking for 300 degree water that you could flash into steam when it comes up out of the ground and drive turbines that way.
Oh, this is fun. Carl got back in touch. He said, hey, I'm emailing you the photos. We might be able to put them on our website, too, of looking down on Lake Chukotamna from when I flew over it other day. And he says, I know of some small-scale hydro for small rivers and streams providing power for villages, even single homes. And we've heard of that. People have their own penstock.
Mm-hmm,
Is that real? That sort of thing getting funded?
Well, there's no state program to fund individual projects. The Renewable Energy Grant Fund is for utility or community scale stuff.
So what would a person do if they want to look into this technology and they don't quite have the money?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that we all don't have money for.
I want to do a demonstration project for the rest of the state.
Well, I mean, this technology is really old. We've been using it for over 100 years.
You betcha.
If you've got a good resource and you got the rights to the water, I mean, these Pelton wheels have been working for over 100 years. You just need to put the money into it and make it happen.
Get it right off of the shelf. Chris Rose, always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Steve. I just wanted to remind people that our conference is next week at the Dedina Center, Thursday and Friday, June 17th and 18th. The exhibit hall is open to the public for free. You can get more information on our website, realaska.org, or bcaaconference.com.
All right. Thank you. Time's up. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, Connie Huff. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.